Good morning, Justice Holland, fellow justices. I represent the plaintiffs in this case, plaintiffs who are appellants. It's two corporations, Brandywine Smyrna, Inc. and BCP Smyrna, Inc. One of them owns the business and the other owns the real estate that together are a Chrysler Dodge Jeep dealership on Route 13 in Smyrna. Just as a matter of local reference, having absolutely no relevance to the case, back before Route 1, you used to drive by it all the time on your way through Smyrna. In September 2007, the plaintiff, and by the way, occasionally I will lapse and just refer to the plaintiff in the singular because they're owned by the same individual, both corporations. The plaintiff contracted with the defendant for a roof job, defendant Millennium Builders, and as set out in the statement of facts in my opening brief, on September 22nd of 2007, portions of that roof were opened up despite an ominous weather forecast, and the areas that were opened up were directly over the nerve center for the dealership, directly over its finance offices, computer equipment, showroom. And there were devastating results of the rain that fell through there, accumulated and came right down in a funnel. And devastated the building, and again, that's in the statement of facts in the opening brief. The claims process began right away with the first party carrier, Graphic Arts Mutual, but no money was forthcoming.
Can we jump ahead to the issue?
All right, well, the issues in the case are that after a jury trial, and the verdict sheet is in the appendix at A149, the jury awarded $612,659. There were various post-trial applications, and the one that brings us here today is the trial court's determination on prejudgment interest.
Let me ask you about the award. You brought an action in tort and for breach of contract.
Yes.
Was that any part of this award allocated to a tort, any part allocated to a breach of contract, or is it both?
No allocation on that, Your Honor.
So what is the inference that we should draw? Is this $612,659, is that damages for breach of contract, or is that damages in tort?
Both the first two questions in the jury questionnaire were answered in the affirmative, that it was negligent in a manner proximately causing and breached its contract by failing to perform in a workmanlike manner. But there's no differentiation between the damages awarded as between negligence and contract.
So the jury found liability on both theories?
On both theories and awarded the $612,000. The matter of prejudgment interest was briefed to the court below, argued in November of 2010, and decided with an opinion that brings us here today. The basic place I stand, and thousands of plaintiffs have stood before, is on the basic principles of Moskowitz that prejudgment interest is a matter of right, and there are numerous decisions for that, and they're accumulated.
It's a matter of right, but conferred by common law, correct?
Conferred by common law, and there are qualifications to it. But but the starting point is nonetheless the Moskowitz principle, and I can't literally fault the trial court judge for missing that because she states it right in her opinion at the text at footnote 5. She cites Moskowitz. So the issue on the appeal was the validity of the trial judge's decision to deny interest regardless of that basic proposition, and what are the reasons she gave.
Well, Mr. Goddess, I know the jury came back on favorable to your client on both theories.
Yes.
Let's assume hypothetically this was only a tort case, exclusively tort. Would you be entitled to prejudgment interest under the facts?
I would argue that we are. Yes, Your Honor.
Not for the
full amount, but for the amount of damages paid. I'm not aware of a case, maybe I'm not reading them well enough, that literally says because tort, you don't get prejudgment interest. I think the fact of the matter is that...
No, I'm talking about the statute, and if you make a...
2301?
Yeah. No, the statute that we've construed that said, you know, if you're, the verdict comes in less than you requested, that you're not going to get prejudgment interest?
Well, Your Honor, may I answer that question with a question that occurred to me as I was thinking over this? What if the no pretrial demand had been made whatsoever? I mean, does that one letter trigger all the consequences, or is the court intending to hold that in tort cases, in the broad category of tort cases, there is no opportunity for prejudgment interest regardless of the nature of the damages, whether they're precisely calculable from a checkbook or they involve matters such as damage to reputation in a libel case or pain and suffering past, present, and future, and all those sort of imprecise, soft, very real but soft manner of damages, the softer, imprecise damages have never been allowed prejudgment interest in our courts, so far as I'm aware, for the reason that they are incalculable. Indeed, plaintiffs' lawyers are admonished to not try to put an artificial calculation on them by saying, Mike, you know, how much would you give for a year of pain? My client is going to go through 50 years of pain. You know, you're not allowed to monetize, to liquidate, to talk in precise terms about general damages for pain and suffering and the typical tort damages. But I would say if this were solely a tort case, at least the damages for the cost of repair, to make my client whole under the principles of Moskowitz, have to be given interest.
And what is that amount?
For that amount?
Yes.
As determined by the jury, was $372,362.
So let me see if I have your position clearly. You're saying, number one, the statute, to the extent that the verdict was for liability based on a contract theory, the statute doesn't apply at all.
Doesn't apply at all.
Number two, to the extent that the verdict was predicated on a tort cause of action, you're entitled to prejudgment interest under the common law because the statute is not, to use your terms, it's a sword but not a shield, and all the statute does is carve out one discrete scenario under which common law prejudgment interest would not be allowed, and that is not a scenario that occurred here.
Once again, Your Honor, you've articulated my position better than perhaps I, well, obviously better than I have. The language I am sailing against, not only am I appealing from an opinion by a judge in my home county, but I'm appealing, I guess, against the language in the Enrique State Farm decision, which was en banc, and that's a heavy burden for me with, you know, all five members of the court signing on to that opinion. But I truly do suggest that Enrique language, with as much deference as I can give, that language was not well thought out, where it says, quote, in Delaware, prejudgment interest only becomes an obligation of a litigating party, here the uninsured motorist carrier, when that party rejects a demand before trial for an amount less than what the jury awards as damages. I'd respectfully suggest that language is incredibly broad, where it says in Delaware, that I guess means the Chancery Court as well.
Well, you're arguing that language should be restricted to the facts of the Enrique case?
Either the facts of the Enrique case or tort damages for general, you know, tort claims for general damages, unliquidated damages. It doesn't speak to contract cases. It doesn't speak to Chancery cases. And yet there is that broad language that says in Delaware, prejudgment interest only is an obligation when. There's no mention of Moskowitz or any of those cases footnoted there. You know, I fault is probably
wrong. Mr. Gattis, so let's assume for the moment that we were to agree with you that the statute doesn't apply for any or all of the reasons that we've just discussed. And so it was error for the trial court to deny prejudgment interest on the basis of that statute. There's still the question of... that is, you still have to deal with the finding of the court that prejudgment interest was already awarded by the jury in any event. You claim that it was not. Your friends on the other side claim that it was. How do we resolve that issue?
Well, that moves to the third argument I intended to discuss here. At the surface, it does appear to be a reasonable holding to say, well, the jury awarded interest, and to award interest on that is interest on interest, which is a buzzword, you know, a negative term, interest on interest. But the facts don't hold up. And as a court...
Well, the three possibilities, let me just, you know, before you get in, launch into your explanation, I want to know which pigeonhole it fits into. It either... The verdict either did award prejudgment interest or it awarded no prejudgment interest, or there's a fact issue that needs to be resolved as to whether or not the jury awarded prejudgment interest. Where are we?
Where we are is that the jury did not award prejudgment interest.
As a matter of law?
As a matter of... Precisely as a matter of law. I would say it's a... I'll hedge and say a mixed question of fact and law. There's nothing in the record... And the briefing here was delayed while our opponent, not delayed, but it was slowed down because our opponents ordered major portions of the transcript. There is nothing in the trial where the jury was requested to award prejudgment interest. They were not told about interest rates. They were not told, it's never done. Federal Reserve discount rate has nothing to do with what a jury does. There was nothing in closing argument about making them whole, making my client whole, by awarding prejudgment interest. The testimony that did concern interest and the passage of the trial that concerned interest was two discrete items of interest that my client paid out of its pocket. And that's why on the jury sheet it's additional interest expenses, plural. And as I say in the brief, and you know, it's tough arguing, not tough. I'm sorry to argue something so factual here, but there were two components of interest. One was when the bank that had done the floor plan financing for my client for years was getting weak knees because my client, the site looked terrible. They were trying to sell new cars, looked like a used car lot out of a trailer, raised their floor plan interest rate. That was one component of interest. It has nothing to do with the carry.
Well, you're saying the jury awarded a certain amount that was labeled additional interest expense?
Additional interest expenses.
Expenses.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And that item was awarded as a matter of damages, as distinguished from prejudgment interest.
Right.
And what was the amount of the additional interest expense that you blackboarded, and what was the amount the jury awarded? Were they the same?
They were not. And I don't have that right in front of me with the notes. The jury awarded $72,650, and I think the figure, I can find the figure that was awarded. It was, the sum of $32,062 and $61,597. It's in my briefs. It's about $93,000.
If the jury had awarded what you asked for as additional interest expense, what would the number have been?
Again, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know the exact math, but it's the sum of $32,062, that's from A-142, and $61,597, that's from A-142.
About $93,000, more or
yes.
less.
Yes. And again, I know it's in my briefs, but I don't want to...
But the interest you were claiming was the, so would it be fair to call it floor plan interest?
Well, half of it, ballpark, half of it, about 40% of it, was additional floor plan interest because of the damaged state that my client's business was in. The bank increased its floor plan obligation and increased its rate, and there was unrefuted testimony on that.
So you're saying, tell me if this is right or not, you're saying that the amount that was awarded, the $72,650, was damages, not prejudgment interest.
Yes, sir.
And the damages happened to take the form of interest that had to be paid out.
An additional outlay, yes, sir.
For borrowing in connection with getting this dealership back in operation.
Part of it was a borrowing to satisfy the floor plan lender, and part of it was borrowing to replace working capital. It wasn't borrowed and then written a check to the contractors. The checks had already been written to contractors. But it was a borrowing to restore working capital, which is a Chrysler requirement.
Okay, but your argument that the finding of the court that prejudgment interest was awarded, you're claiming was error as a matter of law because what was awarded wasn't prejudgment interest. Yes. The jury wasn't asked to award prejudgment interest, and the jury wasn't instructed on prejudgment interest.
Absolutely,
is that a fair
Your Honor.
Statement?
And again, I wish I had said it with that clarity. Yes, Your Honor. And further, the amount the jury did award, the $72,650, though less than the combined total of the two interest items that I boarded, was more than either one of them. So it's not as though, well, the jury intended to make us whole. You know, they trimmed both of these just as they trimmed the property damage. They trimmed some of the other numbers in part because of a successful argument and witnesses.
Well, what follows from that? Why is that relevant?
What
that the jury trimmed both figures and
well,
didn't award what you asked?
Well, no, all right, that particular... I'm just saying there's no indication that what the jury did when it came to a lower number for additional interest expenses was intending to make us whole in the concept of prejudgment interest. They trimmed those amounts like they trimmed some of the other amounts, but there's no indication. That's really an anticipation of an argument that I expect from opposing counsel. They had it in their brief. Look, magically, what the jury awarded was pretty darn close to what you get to if you go through this calculation of reducing the 8 months out of business to 5 months that was because of the, you know, I mean, that's all happenstance.
What was the defense argument at trial to reduce the award of interest that you had asked for?
They can speak to it better than I, but it is basically that my client's business was shut for 7.5 months, but rounded, we'll say 8 months. Our expert witness said, you know, once the building gets an occupancy permit, you need 30 days to get it back stocked and everything else. So ours was for 8 months, 8 months of business interruption, 8 months this, that, and the other. And they said, well, look, there were betterments. There were other elements of construction that slowed the opening. There was no reason they couldn't have reopened in 5 months. So basically they apply, I don't know what the number is, but almost to everything they were arguing that it, and that's what they did successfully on.
But as a legal matter, that's all irrelevant, isn't it?
I believe so, Your Honor. And their argument is that it was closed for 5 months. And so you should fractionalize all these numbers. And when the court says it appears the jury's award of interest is consistent, or having scrutinized the trial exhibits, it appears that the jury's award of interest is consistent with the cost of repair covering the period of time which the jury found was reasonable. She doesn't identify, I don't mean to set tasks for a trial court below, but this is a total denial of interest, and I think at that level it becomes an abuse of discretion. There's no elucidation of what it is she's talking about. The opponents didn't even make that argument in their first filing below. They did not make that argument. They said, well, you should start measuring interest from this date or that date or trim, you know, the sort of discussions that typically go on in Superior Court, discussions and argument and a figure is agreed to or ordered, and there rarely are appeals to this court. They didn't even argue this point in their first filing, and in their answering brief to the court, they barely go through the data. They were in that trial. They know the exhibits. They know the arguments that were made.
If we accept your argument that there should have been a prejudgment interest award, would that run from the date of the filing of the complaint?
I think it should run from the date of filing of the, the date of the event.
That's under a tort theory, but under a contract theory, it would run from the date that of the breach, whatever that.
Well, the date of the breach, where the lack of workmanlike performance was on September 22nd of 2007. That's when they didn't, and if you view it as a delivery matter, that's when they didn't deliver what they were supposed to deliver. And the consequences all began then. I mean, the building was closed then.
Well, when was the first demand for payment?
Maybe within about a month after that.
A month after what?
After September 22nd. We don't have that in the record. But there's unrefuted testimony that my client was told, don't get a lawyer or you'll be strung out forever. That's the last thing you should do. And he was operating without a lawyer for the first 4 months. So saying he was slow in making the demand. Therefore,
that's not in the record.
Well, it's in the trial record. It wasn't briefed to the court here, but in their papers below, they did make an argument for saying it should be the date of the complaint, and I responded by pointing out that recall the testimony that he was delayed in filing suit. I mean, filing suit becomes pretty arbitrary. I mean, when I was in, I said, Come on, let's be reasonable. You got a first-party carrier, you got a third-party carrier. You know, we're not trying to make law here. Just get it done.
But the issue of when it would run from was never addressed by the trial court.
That was not addressed by the trial court. And let me add, I'm out of time. But let me just quickly add that, I stand on the number that we developed and documented. I believe it's 167 something.
Well, Mr. Gattis, you're not only out of your opening time, you've also used up all of your rebuttal time.
Okay.
But the court will give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With the court's permission, my name is Michael Boudal. I am counsel with Frank Nardo, and I was counsel in the underlying trial in this matter. I think the first thing that I want to say, and what I think the most important thing, is what is the purpose of prejudgment interest? As I look at the case law in this jurisdiction and even outside this jurisdiction, it's to make the party whole, to make the prevailing party whole, and to avoid a windfall. And
Mr. Boudal, we have two problems here, or two issues. One is whether the court correctly applied the statute to deny an entitlement to prejudgment interest, and secondly, in any event, whether the court correctly found that prejudgment interest had already been awarded by the jury. Let's focus on that.
And that was exactly what I was about to do.
To the extent that the jury award was predicated on a theory of contract, would you agree that the statute doesn't apply by its own terms?
By the actual black letter of the statute, yes, it talks about tort action.
I think it's now been established that the jury found liability on both contract and tort theories.
They did.
Okay. To the extent that the award is predicated on a tort theory, why isn't it the case?
Well, in this particular
situation, I haven't finished yet.
I'm sorry, I apologize.
Isn't it the case that the statute, which is in derogation of the common law, shouldn't be construed as creating one very narrow, discrete carve-out as opposed to supplanting the common law in its entirety on the subject matter of prejudgment interest?
When you come to another jurisdiction, one of the things I always think you should do is sit back and actually look at the cases that formulated the common law. And what I did is look at Moskowitz and the other cases before, and then I looked at the statute, and I try to look at the legislative history. When they wrote this statute, they wrote it specific, and I thought what they said is in any tort action for compensatory damage.
Well, before you answer that,
sure.
Let me clarify my question.
Sure.
Was there a pre-existing common law right to prejudgment interest?
If you look at the 1978 decision in Moskowitz, they say that it's a matter of right and not discretion.
So the statute either had the impact of supplanting that entire right, at least in tort cases, or it didn't. And if it didn't, then it had some lesser effect, such as creating a narrow carve-out. How do we decide?
Yeah, my problem in this is you can exercise, as the plaintiff, whether or not you want to actually go under 6 Delaware Code 2301D. Because to do that, you have to follow a certain formula. You have to extend a written offer. It has to remain open for 30 days. You have to pursue that, which is exactly what the plaintiff, now appellant, did in this case.
Well, that's a defendant's. I mean, the statute allows the defendant to adopt that strategy, and if it works in accordance with the terms of the statute, the plaintiff then is denied the right to prejudgment interest by legislative decree.
That's
but
correct.
This is not that case.
Well,
this is the case that turns that on its head, does it not?
I don't see that. If counsel believed that this was the type of case that would not fall under the statute, and they call it the reject settlement offer statute, then there would be no reason to make that demand. In other words, if he felt that under Moskowitz and the preceding cases, he automatically had a right under tort to receive it, why bring it?
plaintiff's counsel make demands all the time in an effort to avoid litigation.
But if you're going to bring the action under the statute, make the demand, then I think you have to follow the statute.
Well, did they bring the action under the statute?
They sure did. They wrote a letter and they specifically said settlement.
Does the complaint plead a cause of action under the statute?
No. What they did instead is send a settlement demand indicating that, consistent with Delaware Code 230.01d, this settlement demand is valid and capable of acceptance for 30 days.
Okay, so there's language in a demand letter, but no explicit cause of action pled in the complaint.
It was solely a negligence action.
What's that?
It was solely a negligence action. They did not mention the statute.
Negligence and contract, right?
That's right.
So your position is that, as far as a tort claim, if the statute is not cited and a demand is not made under the statute, there's no entitlement to prejudgment interest.
Under a tort claim. Then you deal with the traditional law of the Commonwealth here. You've got to deal with Moskowitz and the prior cases. Is this case, one, capable of ascertaining damages? Is it subject to prejudgment interest?
Is it your position that if there had been no demand in this case, that demand for settlement, that the plaintiff would be entitled to prejudgment interest on a tort claim?
No, I don't. I don't think they've been entitled under tort or contract because the nature of the case itself. The nature of this case was such that it was literally incapable of ascertaining, certainly at the time of this loss and later, what the actual damages would have been.
Even at the time the complaint was filed?
Even at the time the complaint was filed. The number that the plaintiffs were seeking always was changing. They never could calculate it because they were claiming damages for lost sales, lost parts, lost services for a period of time that extended way past when they needed to complete the work to be done to put them back in the work. And they hired one single person to calculate those numbers. That person's numbers changed every single time he testified. Every one of these numbers kept on changing and changing, and so you could never determine what, if anything, they were claiming. It changed even at trial. It went from the opinion letter to his testimony at deposition to his second date to the trial. I mean, it was just a moving target. We could never calculate it.
Just to go back to the statutory issue for a moment, counsel, I gather that your position is that even though there's nothing in the complaint refers to Section 2301, that by couching the demand in terms of Section 2301, the plaintiff elected to proceed in accordance with the statute, even if the statute by its own terms would not ordinarily apply.
That's correct, sir.
Okay, so we're dealing with some, a voluntary assumption to be bound, or a voluntary implicit agreement to be bound by the term, by the game, the rules of that game.
You're making an election to bring a claim and to seek damages under a statute.
Okay. And if that had not been done, that is, if there were nothing in the demand that alluded to the statute, then would we be here?
At that point, we would, I think we would be here because of another ruling that the court made, which I think is clear in my mind, and that is the question of double recovery.
Okay, well,
And we may be here also, and I'm anticipating your question, and if I'm wrong, please state, that I think under Moskowitz and the other cases, this case was not susceptible to prejudgment interest as it rolled
out. That's because of the moving target?
Yeah, factually. It just never would have happened. And if I might, I think some of the answers will come with the second area that I think is most significant. What happened here is it's our position that when the court instructed the jury about their ability to provide interest income, in essence, what the judge said and what we said is that this additional interest was nothing more than prejudgment interest. It's rare.
That was argued to the jury?
What was argued to the jury was that they weren't entitled to any interest, and if they were entitled to interest, it had to be the amount of interest for this particular the work that would have put them back into condition to be able to get back into their job, not just the amount of interest income that was being claimed.
But they weren't instructed on the Federal Reserve discount rate.
They were not, but what they, I'm sorry, I apologize.
All of the elements that would have to be used to accurately calculate prejudgment.
But what they were instructed on, in fact, the instruction was incredibly broad. And what I was about to say is that you very rarely get a jury to the ability to make a determination factually what the damages should be, what the cost of repair is, what the lost sales were, what the lost income and parts and service, lost rent. And then at the end, after you calculate that, we're also going to let you calculate interest to make them whole.
Well,
if I could, I'm sorry, I don't mean to.
The trial judge did find that the jury had awarded prejudgment interest. Is that fair?
The judge did.
Okay.
I don't know if you called it necessarily prejudgment interest, but she found that interest that would make the court the plaintiff whole.
Well, she either said that they awarded prejudgment interest or the equivalent of it.
That's exactly right.
And is that an argument that your side advanced to the trial judge?
Yeah, that's exactly what we did. That's exactly, at length we did. And what we basically said is that unlike what counsel is arguing here about a very specific type of interest, and he used the term floor plan financing and mortgage interest, what the instruction to the jury was is the plaintiffs may be entitled to recover other aspects of damage which they suffered,
well,
or expenses that they incurred as a consequence of the accident.
If you're right, if that's what was argued,
yes,
and if that's what the jury did, that kind of undercuts your position that there was a moving target and that this case doesn't lend itself to prejudgment interest.
Oh, well, let me explain why. And it came up briefly in counsel's, and if I cut you off, I apologize. I'm not trying to. I know I have a limited amount of time. In this particular situation, what made this unusual is, and what the plaintiff was arguing is, hold it, we had this loss and we sustained damages, and you wouldn't pay us right up front. So what I had to do to keep my business going is to take out a loan. And out of that loan, I paid not only to rebuild the property and pay for personal property, but I also had to keep my business going with regards to sale and sales, lost service, parts. And I want to be made whole. And that's exactly what was argued. They wanted to be made whole. The problem was that they did not simply restore the building as it was. We're dealing with a 1930s building. They had just built across the street a new service center that was going to hold the trucks. It was state-of-the-art. They had a new parts and service which is operable on the date of this loss. What they decided to do is not just repair the building, you know, for the water damage, because a lot of the water was in the bays that they weren't going to even use anymore, which were just concrete floors, concrete walls, block walls. They totally gutted the place. They took out over $1 million loan. They no longer just had a new roof. They had new exterior. They was all stucco to look exactly like next door, all new windows.
Well, can it be inferred that the jury took all of that into account, which is why they awarded an amount less than the plaintiff claimed for interest?
That is exactly what they did do, because we showed them photo after photo of what it looked like before.
If that's the case, then doesn't that mean they did not award prejudgment interest?
Well, what they did do, if I might, is they made an award not of what plaintiff asked, but they made an award of what they determined should have been paid to restore the property to the condition it was in prior to the loss. They also made a determination, I perceive, that the period of lost sales should not have been 8 months, because if you would have just restored the building to its original condition, it would have been a much shorter time with less sales.
Is the plaintiff entitled to an additor to reflect the amount of at least a portion of the floor plan interest and the borrowing to replace working capital?
The question is, and they had to make that determination, and that was the argument. We took this loan. We want to be made whole. We want interest that we had to pay for all of these things. And that's exactly what the jury did. They did not give them the amount that was paid. They gave them the amount that they felt was fair in the amount of interest.
They gave them about $20,000 less than what
was asked for. Yeah, to make them whole.
Now, but would you agree, just as a conceptual matter, that there's a distinction between prejudgment interest on a damages award and an award of interest as an item of damages, which becomes part of the judgment?
And I do understand the distinction. I understand that one is filed afterwards. The problem is, very rarely, if ever, does the jury get the opportunity.
I'm just asking whether there is a valid distinction conceptually.
There is a valid distinction conceptually, but not practically. What I'm getting at is the jury is sitting there. They're the ones that are the fact finders. We usually don't disturb the jury's verdict because we believe that they have the opportunity to perceive and see the exhibits, listen to the witnesses and testimony. In this particular case, they had to make a determination how to make them whole. Rarely does a jury get the opportunity to rule on interest as well as damages. Here they did that. Here they got the opportunity in a very generalized instruction. If additional expenses, interest was generated, award that as well. And that was the argument. Are you entitled to any? If so, how much? And what Her Honor stated, and again, she's the one that reviewed the exhibits, as she said, having scrutinized the trial exhibits and also having been at this trial for several weeks and listened to the evidence, she felt that it is consistent with the interest on the cost of repairing as well as maintaining the operations. And it could be calculated precisely. Therefore, the court finds that the jury did compensate the plaintiff for prejudgment interest.
Is there a basis in the record for the jury to have rejected every dollar of interest claimed by the plaintiff for the floor plan interest and the borrowing to replace working capital?
Yeah, there is.
And what is that?
One of the accountants testified, Mr. Hare testified, I think his testimony is provided to you in the appendix, that there was no reason, if they were simply going to restore the property to the condition it was in, they could have done that at having looked at his working capital and the amounts they had. There was no reason to actually take a loan out. They could have easily done this, paid for it without any problem or borrowing. They wouldn't have needed any interest, and then they would have then been whole. They could have then sought interest on that. But what they did instead is they chose to not just restore the property. They chose to spend over $1 million to totally gut the place, build a new building, and by doing that, forced themselves to take out a loan and therefore sought interest as well. And that is in the record. If I could, I know I'm limited in time, so let me just, as I said, I believe what happened in this case, two points I really want to make, is that the judge heard the evidence, looked at the exhibits, listened to the jury, gave the instruction, and the jury was providing interest. Whether they called it prejudgment interest or additional interest, what they were doing, which is the sole purpose, I believe, of prejudgment interest to begin with, is to make them whole. Give them all the costs that they felt would have restored them to the condition they were in prior to the loss, including lost sales and parts. And then, on top of that, because the money was not advanced by the defendant, give them interest as well to make them totally whole. I thought when the court said...
What is the rule of law that we should apply? Let's assume that we accept your position that there's evidence in the record from which it could be inferred that the jury awarded zero for the amount of additional interest that the plaintiff was claiming for the floor plan and the borrowing to replace.
Okay.
But there's also a potential inference that the jury did not do that, that they awarded a portion of the additional interest claim, but basically reduced it from 8 months to 5 months, as Mr. Gattis is suggesting. So what's the rule of law that applies in that circumstance? Which inference, permissible inference, controls for purposes of our analysis?
Obviously,
when the plaintiff won and your side lost.
Well, because the rule of law goes to all the case law in this jurisdiction on prejudgment interest, and quite frankly, the commentators as well. The whole idea of prejudgment interest, I started with this by saying, is to make them whole and not give the defendant a windfall. We paid the fair market cost of restoring them to the condition they were in before. And on top of that, because we did not advance the sum, which is the whole point of prejudgment interest, if you would have given it up front, I don't get prejudgment interest. We also had to pay interest. and the jury, as the fact finder, decided how much interest was proper. And I think that's the key. If I could, one of the questions that came up in oral argument I just want to deal with is, on what day does interest run? In this particular case, it doesn't run from the date of the loss because we were not capable of calculating prior to the judgment. It's not when the breach doesn't occur simply because we did not do the work in a workmanlike manner for breach of contract. It's a much longer period of time because we talked about it. They had to renovate the property. The idea is to determine what amount, when, at what time could we calculate what the actual loss was so that we could have paid pretrial due. We'd have no idea, just like in a personal injury case, how long a person would treat, how long, what kind of recovery they would have.
Mr. Boudal, since your time's up, why don't you just tell us what that date is?
I believe the date, well, first of all, I've taken the position that I don't think we ever got a number.
And, I understand that.
And the jury had to make their own decision because they took nobody's numbers. They made their own decision. But I think the number would have been certainly after the lawsuit was filed and when the numbers that were actually provided by their expert, Mr. Santora, were given to us to even know what they were claiming. Because up until then, we'd be guessing.
So do you have a date to suggest?
It would be the date of Mr. Santora's deposition, I believe. And I unfortunately don't have that in front of me right now. He did testify at the trial, and we did put in his transcript.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for the indulgence of 2 minutes. I don't mean to speak brusquely, but I do want to cover a lot of things. First of all, the interest that was documented to the jury, two exhibits, they're in the record at 142, A142 and 143. Those loans began in March, and interest began to be paid in April of 2008. So right off the bat, there is no way that this adequately compensated my client for his out-of-pocket because he started paying bills the very next day, you know, to hire people to put in the blower fans and start getting out the wet drywall and hiring electricians and the like. So already they're 6 months at a time when the Federal Reserve discount rate was high. It did start to plunge, the Federal Reserve discount rate. That may be sort of a driver of what's going on here one way or the other, but the Federal Reserve discount rate was high in September of 2007. Mr. Boudal has sort of artfully gotten to the point of suggesting I'm trying to change the jury verdict. I'm trying to challenge the jury verdict. I'm not. He commends the judge who said, you know, I've looked at the exhibits and implicitly I was at the trial and this is what I think the jury did. And Mr. Boudal was there. He had an opportunity to write in his brief. He had an opportunity to go into the exhibits and talk about the specific exhibits. He had an opportunity to cite from his closing argument. He didn't. He's the one who was saying against documentary evidence that we're talking about two loans that were paid out of pocket. He's the one who has to somehow link that up to being the equivalence of prejudgment interest.
Well, he suggests that there's a basis in the record to infer that the jury awarded $0 on your interest claim.
There's nothing of the sort, and there's nothing in the briefing, Your Honor.
Even though the renovation and all of this expense from their side's point of view was unnecessary.
Yes, Your Honor. And they would have cited that if there was a basis in the record for that. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you all.
Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.